Caring for someone you love is one of the hardest and most profoundly human things you may ever face. And yet, when the moment arrives, most of us would feel very unprepared, overwhelmed, and probably deeply alone. My guest today, journalist and health communicator Casey Berros, has lived this reality. When her dad became unwell, she stepped into the role of carer, and that role tested her, broke her open, and ultimately taught her lessons she now shares in her new book, Next of Kin. It's a story about navigating a complex medical system, surviving the emotional roller coaster of care, and perhaps most importantly, finding meaning and love in the midst of loss. So, Casey, today we are exploring what it truly means to care and to grieve and to keep moving forward with strength, compassion, and humanity. This must have been an incredibly difficult book to write without pouring too much heart into it and yet keeping it practical for us as readers.
Yeah, it was. I say that it's sort of a heartfelt companion and a practical guide. I've tried really hard to make sure that I had both of those things so that people are learning but also kind of getting lost in the narrative. And it was hard to write, some parts of it particularly, but it was also incredibly cathartic. It was what a gift to get to wrap my experience up into a book for other people to kind of learn from. It's everything that I wish I knew before I stepped into the role of dad's primary carer and everything that I learned along the way. So I feel lucky, very lucky to have got to write it.
So I'm suggesting that this book is a great one for people to read before they arrive in the position that you are in and use it, I guess, as a guideline, as a Bible for what's coming next.
Very much so. I say to people, read it before you need it, then put it on the shelf and let it gather dust and just go on about living forever, as we're all planning to do, and then pick it back up when you need it. That said, if somebody is already caring, if they are already in crisis, this book I hope will be a lifeline for them. But I certainly remember in the initial days of dad's diagnosis or the really sort of acute phase at the end, I don't know that I would have had the bandwidth to read a book. I was constantly given pamphlets and little guidebooks and really well-intended great pieces of content from hospices and social workers and services, and I didn't read any of them. I dipped back into them when I was writing my book so that I could put it all into one place. But once you're in crisis, you're thinking, you know, 2 hours ahead. What needs to happen in the next 2 hours, in the next 2 days? And so, yeah, if you can, read it before you need it.
That's a really lovely lesson, because I remember that one book that I'm sure a lot of my generation had when we were pregnant was What to Expect When You're Expecting. And you did. You binge read it when you first fell pregnant, sort of prepared yourself for it, and then put it away, worried about your pregnancy, got through those bits. And then once the baby arrived, it's like, oh, flick to chapter 7. I need to find out what's going on again.
Exactly.
That wonderful book, something to reach for in a time of need and crisis. And that's what Next of Kin, I'm sure, will become for so many. We are heading into that phase of our lives, and sadly, I'm sure a lot of us have already been through that without the helping hand. Can you tell us a little bit about your story and your journey with your dad and when that started, how old you were, how old he was?
Yes. So I got a call from dad in June 2021 saying that he had been diagnosed with mesothelioma. So for people who don't know what that is, it's cancer from exposure to asbestos. It is fatal, incurable, real bad news, poor prognosis almost always. And whilst you can treat it, it's not treating to be curative. It's treating to buy time and reduce symptom load, essentially. So I will never forget receiving that call. You know, I think we live our lives in fear of receiving those calls, the ones where it feels like life's picked you up by your ankles and given you a good shake upside down. And I was living in Sydney at the time, had been living in Sydney, but I grew up in Perth. So we were on opposite sides of the country. And I very quickly got my little family on a plane back to Perth. And I think the plan in my head, at least, was we'll just get back there and we'll just walk him through a few appointments. We'll work out the lay of the land. We'll get a bit of a sense of you know, what the next 6 to 12 months might look like. And then I thought that maybe my husband would come back to Sydney and keep working, and that maybe I would stay with the girls for a while. People might remember June 2021, the borders were closing frequently, lots of people pleading with politicians on the Today Show to please let them in to say goodbye to their dying relative on the other side of, you know, between New South Wales and Queensland border would be shut. And I was desperate for that to not be our story. So we very quickly jumped on a plane and came back to Perth, and the borders shut behind us 12 hours later. And at that time they were saying that they were shut indefinitely. So we couldn't leave because I was too scared that we wouldn't be allowed back in. So we had sort of inadvertently moved back to Perth. And I don't remember thinking I'm going to move back to Perth and become dad's primary carer. I probably wasn't even really familiar with that terminology then, but I found myself in that position very quickly. And all families are different. We have these sort of traditional families where a mum and a dad are still together, and then there's siblings and they all live in the same place. That wasn't our story. My mum and my dad split when I was very little. My dad had 5 children to 4 different women. So my family tree looks like a bit of an explosion in a pen factory. He was a bit of a wild spirit, but we were very close. And so there was no question in my mind that he had walked me into this life and that I would be walking him out. And I always say I'm an eternal pessimist, which I think serves me well in those settings, because they said 6 to 12 months, and what I heard was 6 at best. So we kind of leapt into action. There was no waiting around to see what happened. We just immediately launched into, well, we're going to be there and walk him through this. And I'm so, so glad that we did.
Can I ask, are you the oldest of his children? Do you think this sort of falls on the elder sibling often?
I think typically it does. I'm not. I'm the second eldest. The oldest lives in America and has done since she was very little. So it kind of wasn't really an option to have her support. Somebody asked me the other day whether or not I felt called out of duty, and it didn't feel like that in the moment. It felt like compulsion, like there was no question that I would be there for him to walk through that. And look, I have to own my privilege here. We were able to survive on one wage, my husband's wage. Not everybody will be able to do that. My husband's a teacher, but we were able to survive on just his wage, so I could take a big step back from my work. I work for myself, so I wasn't leaving full-time employment. My kids were very little. They weren't in school yet, deeply ingrained in their communities, so I was only ripping them out of daycare. And we were in a position to be able to get us all on a plane and move across the country. And not everybody, care is not a choice for everybody. They have to keep working and they have to provide the care because there are no other options. And so I feel very lucky that I had that choice, that I wasn't trying to hold down a 9 to 5. And there are all sorts of costs associated with that. We lived on one wage. We were very, very lean for those years. There's lack of career progression, not earning any money, not putting any money into my super. There's all of those sorts of quote unquote costs, but they were costs that I was willing to pay to be able to have the privilege of getting to walk him through that.
A quick pause for anyone interested in joining our DNA testing program in partnership with Fit Genes, a world-leading genetics company. So many of you have already joined our Fit Genes community. So now, for anyone who hasn't, it's your turn. Get to know your genes with us. When you know your genes and your unique genetic breaks, you can do something about it. For us here at the Aging Project, we've learned it's the best first step in our aging well journey. If you'd like to learn more, visit theagingproject.com and join the Fit Genes waitlist. We'll send you all the details so you can get started. When you heard that initial diagnosis, and I'm sure you jump into action, don't you? And as you said, you hopped on the plane, you got over there, we'll sort the rest out later. When it became a little bit more routine, I suppose, when once you had settled in Perth and the daily grind of caring for him and appointments, et cetera, when did you realise that this might have been your purpose?
Oh, that's a great question. I think a lot about sort of the emotional toll of care, and it is really hard yakka. Like, it's hard yakka physically, mentally, socially, spiritually, financially, emotionally, all of the lees. It's really, really tough. And in my experience and many other carers that I speak to, you also feel lit up with purpose. It does feel really purposeful, really meaningful. And as part of my research for this book, I interviewed a guy called Professor Mark Schultz. He's a professor of psychology. He's based in Philadelphia. And he was one of the co-directors on the Harvard study of adult development. So one of the longest studies that we've got on essentially what makes for a good life. And I was telling him that my experience of care was that it was one of the most challenging times of my life, but that it was also incredibly purposeful and meaningful and rich. And he was telling me about the fact that in the Harvard study of adult development, the original cohort from back in 1938 was 91% men and a huge, it was 100% men. And because it was based on men that were allowed to go to Harvard, people that went to Harvard, only men were allowed to go to Harvard in 1938. So that in the original cohort, it was only men. And of those men, 91% of them had served in the war. And he said that the way that I had described care, and more broadly, the way that carers describe that experience, is very akin to what people who have experienced war and the way that they describe it. He said that they talk about it with real reverence, that their experience was so harrowing. And I don't know what that's like. I don't claim for a second to know what it's like to go to war. But there's this real similarity between the way that carers describe their experience and the way that people who've been to war describe their experience. And he said that there are a few key reasons for that reverence. And that was that they had been on a mission that felt really meaningful and purposeful for them, mm-hmm. and that they were working as part of a team, and that that team needed to feel like you had real trust and that you were working together. And that is exactly what care can feel like. I appreciate it's not everybody's experience, but you do feel like you're part of a team. You do feel like this mission, this goal, which could be supporting this person that you love dearly or saving their life or buying them time or whatever it might be, that goal is, it's really special. And so whilst you are depleted, exhausted, burned out, all of the things that we know happen to carers, you also feel really on purpose. So to answer your question, I don't know when I realized that, but what I do know is that when I felt like I was white knuckling, that I was crawling, I also felt completely lit up with what I was able to deliver to this one life, to my dad's one life that was very rapidly being taken away from him. And it's almost as though those two things counterbalanced each other and allowed me to keep going. I suspect it's almost like birth. You know, we're flooded with hormones and endorphins, and even when we're exhausted as parents of newborns, something in us keeps going, and it's love for this little person. And so it did. It felt exhausting and beautifully meaningful at the same time,
and crazily alive, I guess, in a strange way.
Yes. Yes, exactly right.
Being the carer, we often hear, and unless we've been in the situation, you know, there is that who's caring for the carer. Mm. Did you find support, not just in your family, but in the Australian healthcare system? Did you feel like you were supported as a primary carer?
Yes and no. I felt very well supported by my family and friends. I could not have asked for more support from them. In terms of the system, you know, we have one of the best healthcare systems in the world. And I've realized, I've been a health journalist for 20 years now, almost. And what I have realized is that our system is excellent and completely imperfect, difficult to navigate, really complicated. I fell through the cracks all the time, and I'm a very health literate person, as was Dad. And so I think the myth that I busted for myself was that when your health hits the fan, so to speak, we assume that there will be someone in charge, whether it's someone with a clipboard in the clouds, or at least in a hospital office setting, or a GP or something. Somebody would be in charge of stitching all of the services together and making sure that that person was and felt really, really well looked after. And that was a big bubble to burst for me. After so long of championing the healthcare system, reporting on it, loving it fiercely from the outside, once I was in it and really needed it, its flaws, I suppose, became quite apparent. And there are much bigger, better, brighter minds than mine trying to work out ways to fix that. But what I realized is that we are the ones that are in charge. We are the ones that are in charge. Nobody's coming to do it for us. It's us. And that's where carers, I think, can play a really critical role for patients, a much bigger role than I think that they're currently playing. And I think that the system needs to really learn to leverage them. And it is us stitching together all of the different pieces of the system, like playing Lego. All of the different blocks mean something different. They're different colors, they're different shapes. And depending on what game you're playing, e.g., what diagnosis, what disability, what time frame you're working with, you're the one creating the design and working with the blocks to put together what you need as the patient and the carer. And so I learned that very, very quickly, that nobody was coming to do it for us, that was all on us.
So you're the case manager, I guess, for want of a better term, and all of the specialists and everybody else that are working with you, you're the one pulling that all together into some kind of program or schedule or system. There's no one in the healthcare system that does that for a patient.
That's right. And I suppose if some people listening to this who work within the system would probably argue with me on that. They might say things like, well, there's a hospital social worker, or there is maybe the Cancer Council, or one of the big bodies that represent people who have a particular condition. They might have a caseworker in there that you can leverage. But if you don't know that those things exist, and or they're not available based on where you live geographically or whatever it might be, it really is on you. And it's still up to you to engage them, to get them across your case, to help. So I suppose you're almost the puppet master, and you need to work out which strings to pull to get the result that you want, which is why I think the two core skills that everybody needs to adopt as quickly as they can is getting better at navigating the healthcare system, this wonderful healthcare system of ours, and becoming better advocates for ourselves and the people within it. So whilst Next of Kin explores all of these themes through the lens of me caring for a terminally ill parent, I think care shares common ground, whether or not you're caring for someone with a terminal illness, a chronic disease, a mental illness, an addiction, a disability, a particularly neurodivergent child. The core skills are the same. You need to be able to navigate the system, and you need to be able to advocate for yourself or your person within it, regardless of what your Lego design looks like. Those two core skills are the same.
Look, it's hard enough caring for yourself and making your own decisions. I'm sure there was a turning point in your carer relationship with your father where he started to lose the capacity to make decisions for himself. How was that turning point for you when you started off, I guess, as a support, and then do you become the decision maker, really?
It gets really, really complicated. And I think about this a lot because I see a lot of people grappling with, particularly with family dynamics and power of attorney and enduring medical power of attorney and advanced healthcare directives and all of these really big important things that we absolutely all need to get in place. And then there's the human side of that. And this is where advocacy starts to get really tricky. So Advocacy is essentially, if you imagine that you go to a sports field and you're watching a game and the players run out on the field and everyone's hooting and hollering and like cheering them on, and they start throwing, passing this ball to each other, running down the field, and then they get to the other end and they stop and they start looking around and they look really confused. And you look down towards the end of the field and you realize that there's no goals, there's no basket, there's no, so they don't know what a goal is, let alone how to win the game. And that essentially is what, when you are not clear on what it is that you're advocating for, it is impossible to shoot the goal, to achieve the goal, to get what it is that that person wants. And you might not be clear because your person is incapable of communicating with you about it. You might be unclear because what they thought they wanted when they were of sound mind doesn't appear to be what they want when you get to the mm-hmm. other end. They might have changed their mind somewhere along the way. They might have lost their ability to communicate along the way, which is why, you know, having these advanced healthcare plan and directive, having an enduring medical power of attorney and really communicating well with them about what it is that you want when everything is fine, that is what is really important. And as the advocate, you are often the one, you're bad cop, good cop, bad cop. Some days you're good cop and you're on their side. Some days you're bad cop because you're essentially advocating against something that they think that they want or need, but it's not in their best interest clinically, or their doctor's advising against it. And I certainly felt, I felt the pendulum swing on that. You know, I was always good cop, always advocating for what dad wanted and needed. And then towards the end of our journey, he had become very reliant on a drug called fentanyl. And it was great in the beginning until he felt like he couldn't live without it. And his use had increased exponentially, and the drug had stopped having its effect. And that devastated him because it had put wind in his sails where there was none. And all of a sudden it stopped working. And in fact, it started making him incredibly anxious. And so when I would gently recommend perhaps the answer to feeling like this is not more fentanyl, perhaps, and for anybody listening, that's a very, very, very strong morphine style opiate, medically prescribed. You know, when I started suggesting maybe we should just like decrease that a little bit, maybe we should use one of the anti-anxiety medications that the doctors have been recommending now, that very much made me bad cop, unfortunately. And when you're losing someone, that's an awful feeling to feel like they're cranky with you, especially when you're their primary carer. You've given up everything to be there for them, which often a primary carer has to do. That can feel emotionally really fraught.
Was it easy? Had you had, I guess you refer to them in the book, of those hard hat conversations, which I imagine, you know, when you're talking to a physically well, mentally well, capable adult, the parent in a lot of people's situation, to have those hard hat conversations. Had you had those with your dad? So at that time you knew, I'm sticking to my guns, I know what he really needs and what he wants. He's affected in a way that I have to take control here. Did it make you feel more confident in your decisions because you had had those conversations early?
Yes and no. Because it's easy to have hypothetical conversations, even if you're already in a terminal illness setting, but whilst they're still really well, it's much easier to have a conversation that feels hypothetical in that moment. What would you like at the end? Do you want a funeral? Do you want to be cremated? Those are some of the things that are pretty easy to predict or to forecast. What's less easy to predict or forecast would be, using the example that I mentioned, I could never have foreseen that he would become so reliant on that medication to the point of almost being addicted to it, and it kind of changing him towards the end. I could never have predicted that. So I could never have had a conversation with him about that. So there are, you can prepare, and then there will be things that occur, particularly towards the end, that there's just no way that you could have prepared for. But here's an example that you can prepare for that we used with Dad. Dad had always said, that he would do anything for a little bit more time. So if he needed it, for example, he would have CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, so pumping on the chest if his heart was to stop, to buy him more time. We had engaged a doula, a death doula, to help us spiritually and administratively walk Dad through this process. And she had been a palliative care nurse for 25 years. And so she had this incredible clinical wisdom as well as this beautiful spiritual and administrative guidance to offer us. And I remember her saying to me, we need to talk to your dad about the CPR piece because your dad has a terminal chronic degenerative lung condition. Mm-hmm. So Dad's mesothelioma was in the pleura of the lung. So the lining of the lung, mesothelioma, is from in the mesothelium. So the lining of the organs. For Dad, it was in his lung. That's the majority of the time it's in the lung with mesothelioma. And what that meant is that his rib cage, so the piece that is holding his lungs, was also decaying and degrading. And he doesn't know that. His healthcare professionals hadn't said that to him, but this beautiful doula was able to bring to my attention, if somebody was to perform CPR on him and he'd gotten to the point where he needed it, there's every chance that his rib cage would shatter, would not survive. And that would mean that he would spend whatever incremental time he got on the other side of that, he would spend it in hospital on a ventilator. And that's exactly where Dad didn't want to be. So we knew that Dad wanted to die at home. And so this is where you start playing a bit of a game of chess. Like, yes, you would want, you would do anything to have more time. So yes, absolutely resuscitate me if I need it. However, it's really important to me that I die at home, surrounded by my family. If those two things cancel each other out, then there's a choice to be made. So the doula's intel allowed me to be able to bring to Dad's attention and awareness, hey, Dad, if you do need resuscitation, the reality is that you're not a fit, able-bodied, healthy person who on the other side of that resuscitation is just going to be home like you were before that had happened. You will probably spend the rest of your time attached to cords, breathing on a ventilator in a hospital, which as far as I'm aware, what you've told me is that that's the last place that you want to die. So he switched to a do not resuscitate order and we helped him get that in place so that, you know, if we had to call an ambulance at any point, they would know and we would know to be able to advocate for that, that he didn't want to be resuscitated. So this is where health literacy and understanding some of these kind of nuances, I suppose, of experiences that you have never had before. So you've got no idea how to navigate something like that, and strong communication skills. You said hard hat for hard chat. That's the analogy that I use because it's like if you walk into a construction site, you're asked to put on a hard hat. And the reason that you're asked to do that is so that if a brick falls out of the sky and onto your head, the hope is that you will be protected. That is the point of hard hat for hard chat. And they are hard chats, incredibly hard chats. And they're really worthwhile raising because the antidote is, or the opposite is that you get to the other end and you're like, I've got no idea what they would want here. And you're guessing.
So in the book, you talk us through those conversations to have, whether they be, I guess, the legal and financial side of care. I think it's probably a family conversation to have too, isn't it? And that's difficult when you are bringing in all those emotions from perhaps other siblings or the partner or the wife.
Yes.
And do you suggest that families perhaps, I guess, nominate who that carer is going to be? Is that something too when everyone is of able mind and body, and I'm talking, you know, probably about I'm one of four, should we be having those conversations now about who's really prepared to care for our parents?
I think they're great conversations to have, and we know that those things are dynamic and they can shift and change. You know, your situation right now with the age of your children and your geographical location, it might not be possible for you right now, but in 5 years when your children are a little bit older, it might be. So being flexible, I suppose, understanding people's intent. And it's very different to have a conversation about it and then for it to actually occur. You know, are you going to move or am I going to move? Or, you know, I have three younger siblings that are much younger than me. And I encouraged as much as I could, I encouraged them to participate in dad's care. And they were understandably living their lives as young people. I had the benefit of having gone and done all of that, had my partying days and my friends and my family days, and I'd done all of that and I'd settled back into a different phase of my life. So I don't know that you can sit together and be like, okay, let's call it now before we need it. We're going to nominate who's going to do what, but maybe being clear on each other's strengths. So if you've got a lawyer or an accountant in your family, maybe that's going to be their strength. If you've got a nurse or a teacher or a very nurturing person in your family, maybe that's going to be their strength and they're going to do more of the physical caring. Maybe somebody in your family is incredibly financially stable and everybody else isn't, including the parents. Maybe that's something that they can contribute, but they can't contribute physically. I think knowing or at least starting to consider some of that. And I will say this, care is never equal. I haven't come across a family yet who've said it was perfectly balanced, perfectly equal. Nobody fought. It was a dream. Haven't come across one family yet who's told me that. It's never equal. And I have so many conversations with people who say, you know, my brother lives in Melbourne and he didn't come back to Adelaide to help. And then he just swooped in at the last second. And so people always feel upset for that they're delivering more and that other people are delivering less, or that somebody else is handling something in a different way. And I guess all I can say to that is show up with as much integrity as you can muster. And know that on the other side of that experience, what you get for that is to be able to pack it away in yourself in a way that feels good to you. And you can gently encourage everybody else to do the same. But if they're going to act in a way that isn't in accordance with your values, you can twist yourself into as many knots as you like about that. And you will just look and feel like a pretzel. So yes, I think absolutely we need to be having these conversations well before we need to. We need to be doing some thinking around this. So if anybody's listening to this and they're not there yet, start thinking about, like, if I got the call tomorrow, what would I do? We don't need to obsess over it, but like get a sense of it, because the reality is that it's coming for all of us. And I will say those big conversations in families, I think there are a couple of tips that will help people. The first is plan it, don't thrust it on them. So I'm yet to find a segue that goes from can you pass the pepper to let's talk about what happens when you die. It just doesn't work like that. So I think suggesting that you'd like to have a conversation about those things and then setting a time so that people can gather their thoughts and bring some intention to that conversation, I think that's actually really critical. Some families don't like talking about hard things. I have had so many people say to me, oh, we don't talk about death in my family. We don't talk about money in my family. So you kind of have to know your family and plan it. Don't thrust it on them. The second thing I would say is...
Can I hold you there for a second? Because I'm just thinking through this. And again, I know that our community is going to be in all different stages and levels of where they sit with this with their families now. So I think this is so vital. Mm-hmm. I just had a thought then that I will get everyone in my family this book. Mm-hmm. I will highlight in my colour what I think is vital and important, that everybody knows how I'm feeling about it. Because as you say, it is coming for everybody, and it comes in different packages, doesn't it? It might be a quick diagnosis. It might be dementia, which can often be so long and drawn out. Nothing's going to look the same. So you can't really prepare too well for it. Mm. But to have these conversations with your siblings, with your in-laws, with your partners, with extended family, there's so many people involved in this at the end, I'm sure.
Yes.
That it's not going to come down, it seemed possibly quite clean for some families when it's already decided. I think, you know, we all should be having these vital conversation. It's going to be hard. Get your hard hats ready. Don't do it over Christmas lunch.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. And I think that, you know, every family is completely unique. So your setup, your relationship with your parents, and people bring to care their relationship with that person, their prior care experience, their values, their experience, their bandwidth, their capacity at that moment in time. Like, this stuff is really complicated. And I always say that care is a absolute breeding ground for resentment within families. And it's a real opportunity for connection. And, you know, you can come out the other side closer than you were before, because you are in the foxholes together fighting whatever this thing is. And so, you know, I think planning those conversations and then setting an intention, like be really clear about your objective. And for me, it's this: I'm opening this conversation as a gift to our future selves, so that in future, there's no confusion, there's only clarity. I just want to have this conversation, get really clear, and then we can all forget about it and just go on about living forever. That is the gift. It's putting it all in a box, tying it up in a bow, and then shoving it under the bed. But then when the time comes, not if, when the time comes and you've got to pull the box out, it's all there ready to go. You know exactly, you know exactly, you've got the instructions, you've got the key to the lockbox, and you've had those conversations. And I think that that's really important. The other thing that I would say is acknowledge that these conversations are really hard. So you've had to have the conversation, you've all rocked up to have the conversation, and you'll notice everybody's shoulders are up near their ears. And if you can open that conversation by saying, hey, I just want to acknowledge that these conversations are rough and hard and uncomfortable, you will hear everybody exhale and you will see their shoulders return to their natural position, because simply acknowledging this stuff is really complicated. It's not comfortable to talk about. We have not been taught to have these conversations and have them well. And so I think just acknowledging that and just being really clear on why you're doing this. You're doing this so that in future, when that time comes, it makes everybody's life so much easier. And what that allows you to do as the grievers is to focus on the grief. There's no complication around how things should play out from here on in, because take it from me, I spent all of this time climbing this mountain of getting Dad through what he was going through. And then I realized when I got to the top, I was bent over heaving from getting him from this world and into the next one, I realized that there was another bigger mountain behind it. I just couldn't see it because it was behind the one that I was climbing. And that was the wrapping up of his affairs, the legal side of things. And I will say, Dad had a very straightforward estate, really straightforward, no property to sell. He didn't have much money at all, really simple. And it still took me the better part of a year to sort out his affairs. Amidst my grief, I sat in the DMV or the motor vehicle registry for more hours than I should have had to, on the verge of tears, transferring licensing for cars. And it is the last thing that you want to be doing when you are deep in grief from losing somebody. So this is a gift to you in the future.
There it is in the book, Next of Kin. From a journalist perspective, Casey, Western civilization obviously handles death very differently to other cultures. How do you feel about that?
I think we have lost the art of care and intergenerational care, and we have this incredibly outsourced model of care, and particularly aged care. And I spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, when we look at the blue zones around the world where there are the most centenarians, so the most really old people, 100 and above, there's not an aged care facility in sight. And I think that's really interesting and really telling, actually. And I see all of these headlines about the bank of mum and dad in this current climate, you know, the parents lending their children money in order for them to get into the property market. That absolutely happens in those zones too. But the expectation is that that elder will live with them and be cared for as long as they're around. And that probably sounds a bit idealistic. I appreciate that not everybody's life is set up for that. But what we can see in those cultures is that it's a non-negotiable. There's no way that they would be shipped off to an aged care facility. And what the data tells us is that once people are, they deteriorate really rapidly. So if they can stay at home, like we were able to do with Dad, you know, Dad was promised 6 to 12 months and he got 2.5 years. And if I had a dollar for every nurse that had said to me, you helped buy him that time because of the care that you were able to deliver, because you did keep him at home, you know, I'd be a Kardashian, probably the poorest Kardashian, but nonetheless. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot to be said for the way that the other cultures are doing things. You know, Singapore, for example, their government pays a fee to families like around our age that stay within, I believe it's a 1 kilometer radius of their aging parents, because they know that keeping them around their parents allows for those people to be cared for more effectively. And I think that that's really telling. You know, we're not doing a good enough job of that. And I think from a death perspective, you know, we did a few things with Dad really differently. We had, we called it the party before the after party. Other people might be even more familiar with the term a living wake. So whilst Dad was still around, it was about 3 weeks before he passed away, but he was still kind of up and mobile and on his oxygen machine. And we had 30 people at my house and we all decorated his eco-friendly cardboard coffin that Dad and I had driven and picked up ourselves. And so my kids are putting their handprints on. We had all of his friends come and write him little messages, the most beautiful messages. And he was able to be there for that. We had a potluck dinner. Everybody brought something and we were able to be together and be connected. And a lot of people said to me over the course of that and Dad's after party, we called it. He didn't have a funeral. I couldn't have imagined him at a funeral, let alone, you know, having one. So many people said to me, gosh, you've really made me think about what I would want. We just assume that we're going to pass away and then have a funeral and we'll either be buried or cremated. And those are our options. And that's just not the truth. It should be totally reflective of the person. And for Dad, that was a party at the Bowls Club. We did a sausage sizzle. We had an indigenous fella come and get on the didgeridoo, welcome us all to country. We had postcards that Dad and I had, he'd written a little message and I'd done in Canva and printed for people. And on the back it said, greetings, friends. I've headed off to Italy on my greatest adventure. And so, you know, we were able to bring so much of him to those events. We had, I called it the dad market. So everything that the kids didn't want and that we didn't want to take to Good Sammy's, we brought all of it like it was a garage sale and just laid it all out at the after party. And people took all of Dad's stuff. So stuff that we didn't want, they would take. So Dad's whisk is living in somebody's kitchen. And I love that Dad's whisk is living in their kitchen. You know, it doesn't all just have to go to Good Sammy. So I guess my advice would be like, have a real think about what you want that to look like. It doesn't have to all be doomy and gloomy. It can be really beautiful and exactly what that person would have wanted. And, you know, you can deliver something really special.
Casey, thank you. Thank you for even opening this conversation with us. It does loom for some people. You know, I know that there is a small percentage of people who see death differently. For most, it is always looming in the background. And as we get older and as our parents get older, you know, that loom gets lower, doesn't it? That cloud gets a little bit lower. But you've shown us today how possible it is to, A, prepare and bring it into the light and talk about it as the real life event that it is going to be, and how to do that a little bit differently. So I encourage everyone listening today to jump on to caseyberros.com. That's her website. She's got some amazing links and advice and chat there. And, of course, her Instagram is just a nonstop light in this life about what's coming next and how to prepare for that properly. So that's her Instagram is Casey Berros. Also, we'll have all the links in our show notes. It's caring, it's grieving, it's loving, and it's probably some of the hardest and most profoundly human experiences that any of us are going to have. So thank you for reminding us to maybe think about it a little bit more and not leave it in the darkness until it's too late. So It's a big conversation. I've loved every minute of it. I know we could talk about this for forever. I'm really grateful for your time today, Casey. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. And for anybody who's in the trenches, I am sending you the biggest hug of all.
As always, the Aging Project podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. Always seek medical advice from a qualified practitioner.